Thank you. I am indeed honored to be asked to speak at this celebration. I was a little ambivalent. I wanted to tell about all the things that I owed to Andreas over many years. I will tell you about it, and then I'll explain my ambivalence. Starting sometime in the early 1980s, I realized that if I wrote him a letter with a question and allowed the reasonable amount of postal time for a response, I would get a detailed answer to my question on anything that he knew a lot about, which is practically everything. And when email came in, I realized that I could do the same thing and usually get an answer the same day or maybe a day later. And one of the nice things about this is that in none of those messages did he start out, "Dear idiot." In spite of the fact that about one out of three deserved such a response. I wanted to tell you about one of them in particular because I understand everybody in here knows what an ultrafilter is, so I don't have to worry about that one, except Alan, but I'll let that pass. Okay. If I have a sequence of pairwise disjoint finite subsets of n, okay, by the finite unions of that sequence, we name the set of all union over n and f of un such that f itself is a finite non-empty subset of n. That's the notation I use for such animals. it's finite n non-empty. And u is a union ultrafilter on the set of finite non-empty subsets of n, if and only if for each a in u there exists such a sequence. Okay, so when I write that down, that says assumes they're pairwise disjoint, with the finite union of this sequence contained in A and that finite union of the sequence is a member of U. So this union ultrafilter is generated by these sets of finite unions. And I remembered that there was a paper that he and I had written in which we showed, when I use the word "we show," I should revert to some of my usual advice that many of you have heard over the years, and there are young people in the audience, so I tend to repeat it. It's done wonders for me throughout my career, and that is, find somebody who's smarter than you are and get them to put your name on their papers. It's beautiful. Anyway, so with that understanding, we had shown that the union ultrafilters followed from Martin's axiom. Yes, sir? I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole, Alan. Okay. The union ultrafilters followed from Martin's axiom, and that they implied the existence of p-points, so couldn't be established in ZF. And so just less than a year ago, December 20th, so the email says, I wrote to Andreas and says, say that U is a strong union ultrafilter if and only if the same requirements exactly, except that you require for each n that the maximum of un is less than the minimum of un plus 1. If I write two finite subsets of n saying one is less than the other, that means the max of one is less than the min of the other. And even I could prove using the continuum hypothesis that the CH implied that such things existed. And I wrote him and says, does CH imply that there are union ultrafilters which are not strong union ultrafilters? And he responded that, he had this result in a paper that, in fact, with a different name, they were called ordered union ultrafilters instead of strong, with a different name, yes, indeed, that there did exist union ultrafilters which were not, I mean, assuming NA, that there were union ultrafilters that were not strong union ultrafilters. That paper happened to be the same one that I was a joint author of. Okay, so, now, why my ambivalence about this? Okay, oh, and the response was on December 20th as well. As I said, I sent it, he answered. I was a little afraid about letting the secret out, you know, because I was afraid, you know, poor Andreas would have all these people asking him questions once the secret got out. And then I read the web page for the conference, and it referred to his legendary patience, and I decided that perhaps it wasn't a secret after all, and so I could go ahead and record my announcement. Okay, this is not the topic of the talk. Picking the topic, again, I figured it should be something that he knows quite a bit about. That didn't restrict things a heck of a lot. I decided, well, he likes Ramsey theory. And so that's what the talk is going to be about. And specifically, I'm talking about some various versions of the central set theorem. Now, first of all, let me give you a definition which is due to Furstenberg, who invented the notion in the first place. If you take a subset A of the set of positive integers, is central if and only if there exists X, which is compact metric, there exists T, taking X continuously to X, and there exists Y, which is uniformly recurrent. It's also sometimes called an almost periodic point. The definition of that is, given any neighborhood, the set of returns to that neighborhood under this has bounded gaps. Okay. And there exists X proximal to Y, which, well, in the terms of the metric, they get arbitrarily close to each other with the T to the N. And there exists a neighborhood of Y such that A is equal to the set of all N such that T to the N of X is in U. Okay, it's not going to be on the exam, so don't worry about it. The point of writing that down is it's sort of a complicated notion, but it had a virtue. Okay. First off, there is the theorem which says if N is divided up into finitely many classes, some one of them is central. Okay, that's important from the point of view of Ramsey theory, because in that you want to take something divided into finitely many classes and say one of them is good in some way. So if you can show central sets are good, you've shown that. Okay. And let me put here, I'm going to erase part of this later, so I'll just call this at this particular point theorem A. So theorem A says, if A is a central subset of N, and L is in N, and F1, F2, FL are all sequences in N, functions from N to N, then there exists a sequence AN, N equal 1 to infinity. This is in N. And there exists a sequence HN, N equals 1 to infinity of finite non-empty subsets of N, such that for all finite non-empty subsets of N, the sum over N in F of AN plus the sum over T in H, and missed something here. And for all I from 1 through L, the sum over N and F of AN plus the sum over T in HN of F sub I of T, every such sum is a member of your central set. Now, that, if that's the first time you're seeing that, of course you don't understand what it says in any reasonable sense, but let me give you a very simple consequence, and that is a strong extension of van der Waerden's theorem. Now, you may recall that van der Waerden's theorem says that if you divide the positive integers into finitely many classes, one of them will contain arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions. Okay, the extension of that is that if n is divided into finitely many classes, and you're given any sequence whatsoever, okay, in n, and you're given any specified length, then there exists a, and there exists d, which is your increment, and the increment is in the set of finite sums from the sequence. Finite sums are defined like finite unions, except take sums instead of unions. Okay, so there exists d in the set of finite sums such that a plus d up through a plus ld, oh, and there's one of the cells, I'll put a there, exists I in here somewhere. All of this is contained in the given specified cell. So you can get arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions choosing the increment out of any prescribed set of finite sums. And from that point of view, think of them as very, very thin, you know, like xn could be 2 to the 2 to the n or something like that. Okay. How do you derive it from that? Well, quite easy. What we do is we say, let for I in 0 through L, let Fi of n equal I times Xn. So we have defined L plus 1 sequences. Okay, so here we have, you should stick on F0 here. Pick your AN, your sequence of ANs, pick your sequence of HNs, and throw away all of them except the first one. Okay, so what do you got? You've got given I from 0 up through L, you have A1 plus the sum over T in H1 of F sub I of T is a member of your specified, well, say a J, I just realized them. In whichever of these is central, there's at least one of them that's going to be central. And so what is that? That's A1 plus J times the sum over T in H1 of XT. So you have a simple consequence of a very restricted version. What's more impressive, and again, all of this stuff is in Furstenberg's original work on the subject. If you take a finite system of homogeneous linear equations, and call that partition regular if whenever you divide the positive integers into finitely many classes, one of them contains a solution to that system. Now, some systems are partition regular, some aren't. But, and Rado characterized precisely which ones are. I won't go into that. But if A is central, and you have a system of homogeneous linear equations, which is partition regular, then A contains a solution. So these central sets are guaranteed to be very rich, and you derive that as a consequence of this particular theorem. Okay, now, one of those people I was mentioning, you know, I thought And Andreas actually has gotten off very easy. I only have 3 joint papers with him. But Vitaly Bergelson, I think the count is 22. So I'm better at exploiting some people than others. In any case, he came up with the idea that I think we can prove this theorem for subsets of N which are members of minimal idempotents. Okay, so we have beta N, and as we all know, beta N is the set of ultrafilters on N. And the operation of addition extends to beta N, making this a compact right topological semigroup, which means, to me, that means addition on the right by any element is continuous. And that has, well, there's a couple of ways of looking at it. If you have idempotents in here, you can say P is less than or equal to Q if and only if P plus Q equals Q plus P equals P, and something, an idempotent is minimal, says it's minimal with respect to that ordering. Or you can notice that this has a smallest two-sided ideal, and something is minimal means it's an idempotent is minimal means it's a member of that smallest ideal. In any case, Vitaly says, say that if A is a member of P which is an idempotent in the smallest ideal of beta N, then theorem A holds. He figured we ought to be able to prove that, and we were in fact able to prove that. And furthermore, we were able to prove that this is exactly equivalent to Furstenberg's definition. Okay. Now, actually, the other person that I've exploited even more than Vitaly is Donna Strauss. I just checked last night. The count is 39 papers in a book with her. Anyway, when we were writing this book, I pointed out that this equivalence was not obvious. And at that time, this was after we had email and we were sending tech files back and forth. And I noticed, fortunately watching rather closely, that she deleted the word not when she sent one of these files. And I explained to her that Furstenberg, what I said was not obvious, was it was not obvious that this notion is closed under passage to supersets. Okay. And she said, oh, that was obvious. And I said, well, Furstenberg didn't believe me when I told him. Okay, and so she finally allowed me to stick the word not back in there. In any case, the fact is they are equivalent. Okay, and this of course is a simple notion, and for this definition, the first theorem becomes trivial, of course. And so we have that. In fact, we have a nice simple way of defining in any semigroup. So you take a semigroup, you take, and if anybody doesn't know this, and this is the operation of associative, okay? You take a semigroup, discrete, and you go, and for the moment, we'll stick to a commutative semigroup, which we'll write as plus. Now, I should point out that even though S is commutative, beta S is not. Okay, we still write the operation as plus, and we define A is central if and only if that there exists an idempotent in the smallest ideal of beta S such that A is a member of that idempotent. And it turns out you can rephrase this in terms of an arbitrary semigroup as long as you drop the metric requirement. A couple of guys by the name of Xi and Yang, Chinese, established, in fact, that in any semigroup, the definitions are equivalent. Okay. And in any case, but this is certainly a simpler version, from my mind, than that definition is. And furthermore, one has a simple, now we're going to put here, this is important, S plus is commutative. Okay. And theorem A says that if A is a central subset of S, and L is in N, and F1 through FL is a finite set of sequences in S, then there exists a sequence AN, N equals 1 to infinity in S, and HN of finite non-empty subsets, and I think the rest of it, yeah, goes verbatim. Okay. Now, in fact, when Vitaly and I had did succeed with his advancing his idea, we showed a stronger version, which I'm going to put up here as theorem B. Same situation, S is still commutative. And we say that if A is a central subset of S, and L is a positive integer, and F1, F2, up through FL are any sequences in S, then there exists AN, N equal 1 to infinity in S, and there exists HN, N equal 1 to infinity in, oh, I just realized I left out one of my requirements here. This should have been in the original version of the theorem. One is for each N, HN is less than HN plus 1. So this is a increasing sequence of finite non-empty subsets. So we'll write that for each N, the max of HN is less than the min of HN plus 1. And two, so far it's reading exactly the same, for each finite non-empty subset of N, and for each function phi taking F to 1 through L, you have the sum over N in F of AN plus the sum over T in HN of F sub phi of N at T, should be in A. Okay, so the point being that you can switch from one sequence to another as you run along taking these sums. Okay. Now, when, and I think this actually appeared at least when we wrote our book, we had an extended version, which is what appears in that book, and that reads, if A is a central subset of F, and for each I in N, F sub I is a sequence in S, then there exists a sequence AN, N equal 1 to infinity, and there exists HN, N equals 1 to infinity, the last one, of course, finite non-empty subsets of N. That's that. Item 1 is still the same. It says for each N, the max of HN is less than the min of HN plus 1. And item 2 reads, for all F, finite non-empty subset of N, for all phi taking F to N, leave some space here, we have the sum over N in F of AN plus the sum over T in HN of F sub phi of N at T. is in A. Anyway, so I have to leave it on. I'm sorry. I know it makes it more difficult to sleep, but anyway, there you go. Okay. Well, the reason I left some space here is what I just wrote is false. Okay, and for the simple reason, if you remember that first proof, the first proof where we showed getting arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions, copying the same proof would give you an infinite arithmetic progression. Well, it's easy to divide the positive integers into two classes so that neither one of them contains an infinite arithmetic progression. Just have them consist of longer and longer blocks. And whatever the increment is, it can't jump over it. If you want to entertain yourself, it's possible to divide the positive integers into two classes where there are no blocks longer than 2 in length, and neither side contains an infinite arithmetic progression. That's more of a challenge. And don't ask me to solve it. I don't remember how to do it at this point. Okay, so that's false. So what we need is if for each n in n, phi of n is less than or equal to n, then. Okay, so you restrict yourself to as how many terms you're using at a given particular point. Okay. All right. Now, that was the situation with regard to this stood until quite recently, when Donna and I and a young Indian, his last name is spelled D-E. I was told that should be pronounced Deh. I've never met him, so I don't know how. It's all been email correspondence. Anyway, we noticed that one could prove a Schrödinger version, which says if A is a central subset of S, and T is the set of all sequences in S, so we're handling all the sequences at once, okay, then there exists alpha taking the finite non-empty subsets of T to S, and there exists H taking the finite non-empty subsets of T to the finite non-empty subsets of N, such that, one, if G is a proper subset of, sorry, not, if F is a proper subset of G, then H of F is less than H of G, and two, well, let me erase this temporarily so I don't break my back. If M is in N, and G1 is contained in not equal to G2, contained in properly in each case G sub M, and F sub I is in GI for each I, then the sum from I equals 1 to M of alpha of GI plus the sum over T and H of GI of F sub I of T is in A. All right. Now that one might not be clear to be stronger than C. I mean, on the one hand, you're handling all the sequences at once. On the other hand, it's not so. You say, well, how do you get this from the other? Well, basically, assuming the sequences F sub I were all distinct, you simply let G1 be singleton F1, G2 is F1, F2. It takes a little bit of playing to do it if you have duplication, but not much. And so this is, in fact, easily stronger. Well, stronger, what do I mean by stronger? Okay. What you would like to say is that you could have, say, a subset of n which satisfies the conclusion of theorem A, but not the conclusion of theorem B. You would like to say you have a subset of n which satisfies the conclusion of theorem B, but not the conclusion of theorem C. Likewise for C and D. Well, we can come sort of close for one of the results. Okay. And that is that there exists a subset of the reals. Okay, this is under addition, such that A satisfies the conclusion of theorem A, but not the conclusion of theorem B. Now, crucial in here, in fact, is the fact that the reals are the direct sum of C copies of the irrationals. Okay, just take a Hamel basis for the reals and expand accordingly. Now, what's the point of that? The point of that is, how many sequences are there in there? Well, the same number as you, there are only C sequences there. And so you have the same number as you have coordinates here, and so you can play along and build in a semi-obvious fashion something to just barely satisfy A, and then you have to prove that it doesn't satisfy B. Okay. Now, I won't try to go into the details of that at all, because that particular proof is really not that easy. Okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh no, 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 no. I mean, if they're canceled to be central, it's going to be contained in the uniform ultrafilters. Okay. So now, I mean, you can have trivial situations where a singleton may be central, but in general, no. All right. Now, so you get the idea here. Well, what I want to point out is that's all we can do for commutative semigroups. Okay. I have gone. I was at a conference that included a lot of game theorists a couple of weeks ago, and therefore I had lots of time to play around with my stuff that was on my pad, and I went crazy trying to show in, let's not do this, something simpler. Take the direct sum of C copies of omega. Okay, it's a little simpler because the way you express things in there, I mean, something in there is built up in a very restricted fashion, to show that you could get something satisfying the conclusion of theorem B but not C. And again, it's just the idea. You just make it minimally satisfy the conclusion of theorem B and hope you can show something, and I can't. Go absolutely crazy. We do not have a single commutative semigroup whatsoever and any subset thereof satisfying the conclusion of theorem B and not C, satisfying the conclusion of theorem C and not D. Okay. Now, things improve quite a bit if you switch your attention to a non-commutative semigroup. Okay. Now, what happens, they improve in terms of what we can do. They don't improve at all in terms of the readability of the statement. because what happens is your expressions, see, you have things in there that are built up like this, okay? A plus the sum over T and H of F of T. Now, if we go as customary and write non-commutative semigroups using multiplication, you would do this for these expressions that occur in here, but that doesn't work. And so what you have to do is you split A up into parts. You have an M in N. You have A1, A2, up through AM plus 1, all in S. You have H1 less than H2 less than HM, all finite non-empty subsets of M. And your expression becomes A1 times product T and H1 of F of T times A2 times product T and H2 of F of T times down through AM plus 1. Well, let's do it. Product T and HM of F of T times AM plus 1. Okay, so you have to split up like this, and we call such an expression X of M A H F. Okay, so these things in here all get split up like that. And so, let me run down and put in the non-commutative versions of these things. So S dot is simply a semigroup. So we produce everything along the way reads exactly the same, except here you have product over N in F of X of, oh, there's another. You have a sequence M sub N equal 1 to infinity in N. So it's product N in F, X sub M of N, A of N, H of N, and that's going to be F sub I will remain as it was. And likewise down here, same thing. You're going to have a sequence M sub N equals 1 to infinity in S. Everything else will be the same, except you get down to the conclusion where it's going to be product over N and F of X of M sub N, A sub N, H sub N, and F sub phi of N. Okay. And likewise here, I guess it's still just the same thing, still just M sub N equal 1 to infinity, and still just this particular change in the conclusion. So that's product over N and F of A of X sub M N A N H N and F sub V of N. And the final one, there exists M taking the finite non-empty subsets of T to N, and the conclusion will be the same at the end. So that's the product I equals 1 to M of X sub M of GI alpha of GI H of GI and F sub I. Okay, so all of those things hold. And there we have examples. The examples, if F is the free semigroup on the alphabet C. Okay, so you take the alphabet C, You take all words consisting of finite sequences of numbers of C. There exists A contained in S satisfying, I will write this for shorthand, satisfying the conclusion of theorem A, but not B. And there exists B contained in S satisfying the conclusion of B, but not C. And finally, we can do a little better for the last one, and that is if S is the free semigroup on omega 1, okay, then there exists A contained in S, which satisfies the conclusion of C, but not D. Now, there are two things here that I want to call to your attention. First off, I'm sure you all noticed that even though we have examples for all of those things, we don't have any countable examples. Okay, this is the closest we can come. And this is the only one, you see, that doesn't depend on that little phenomenon that I was talking about, which was the ability that you've got as many elements in your semigroup as you do sequences to play with. And this is actually the simplest proof. What you do is you let S sub lambda be the free semigroup on the ordinals less than or equal to lambda. And what A is the union over lambda less than omega 1 of lambda S sub lambda. And the proof consists in a very trivial fashion. I would give it to you, but I have precisely 2 minutes left, and Joris said in an email at one point that he was planning the talks for 45 minutes with 15 minutes to allow for questions or for the ill-mannered to go over. And I don't want to be ill-mannered, so I am not going to go over. So it's actually a quite easy proof here, and it just hinges on the fact of what the leftmost letter of every word is. Okay. So we're lacking countability and any countable examples, and with one exception, any commutative examples. And I cannot for the life of me believe that there aren't commutative examples. It's just that, I mean, the free semigroup is marvelously easy to play with, okay? Because when you put two things together, you know exactly what they look like, okay? And that having been said, and not wishing to be ill-mannered, I will stop.